Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 7, Safe Spaces for Educators, with Dr. Louise Allen Walker and Dan Williams.
Welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. Today we are joined by two guests. We have a veteran of the podcast, Dr. Louise Allen Walker.
It's dangerous to describe someone as a veteran, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you've added 10 years to my life right there.
Sorry if I've offended anybody. But we also have a shiny new guest, Dan Williams. Welcome. Aww.
Thank you.
How are you
doing?
You
got the better deal there, Dan.
Yeah. Quite terrifying.
You're shiny and new, and I'm a veteran.
Well, I mean, it's been said before.
We haven't yet found an acceptable term for repeat guests, have we? No. Sometimes we call them fixtures, and that doesn't go down well. Podcast legends.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've made a faux pas already. I've managed to upset our guests in the first sentence. So sorry, Louise.
No,
you're
fine.
Please come back again.
You can't flounce.
So. Oh, that was an interesting noise.
That was the door handle breaking. Studio is falling apart around us. Carry on.
Studio poltergeist just making themselves known to
brilliant.
Us. Okay, so we should let our listeners know that we attended a staff professional learning day back in September. And what you're about to hear Louise and Dan talk about is a really great presentation they gave to us based on some research that they're currently still doing, entitled Creating a Safe Space, Introducing a Clinical Supervision Model for the Moral and Ethical Supervision of Students on Programmes Preparing Them for Community-Facing Roles. Now, that was instantly appealing to me because obviously we work with student teachers. Community-facing, absolutely yes. So I guess the first thing you need to tell us really is what is that term clinical supervision model? What is that all about? It's probably a good place to start.
Yeah. Shall I go?
Yeah, you go.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens in a lot of kind of community roles like social work, for example, youth and community work, but also in psychology roles like counsellors, is that when they are working as professionals, they will encounter tricky situations, tricky clients, and maybe they need kind of someone to talk to who is more experienced, who will support them in a kind of non-judgmental way, someone who is not part of their kind of immediate line manager kind of system. And that is what a clinical supervisor does. So they will meet usually fairly regularly to talk through what's going on in their work, maybe get some advice, muddle through maybe some of those kind of moral or ethical grey areas that they've come across in their practice, and just kind of talk through what they're doing and get support from someone who has been in that role themselves and has that experience and can give them support in a non-judgmental, conversational sort of way. Usually it's one-to-one, but there are cases with group supervision where you might have maybe one person leading a group, or peer-to-peer supervision where you have lots of people kind of an equal point of their career supporting one another. But generally it's kind of one-to-one with a professional.
And this was fascinating because I came and had a chat with you about some of this, and my totally blank look when you started talking about this tells us that we don't get this as teachers. So we work in a school, in the university, for anyone that doesn't know our university, which includes social work people, housing work people, youth and community work people, and all of them have this thing. And all of us who are involved in the teaching profession have absolutely no idea about this. So just to clarify then, this is not your line manager giving you a performance management. This is not your mentor, perhaps, when you're a student teacher. Yes, giving you tips and tricks, but also assessing you at the same time with all those sort of grey lines. This is actually a thing where people can peer support one another with no sort of judgment, no assessment, no box ticking involved. This is quite an eye-opener for us, it's got to be said.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's really interesting to come from a practice point of view, because before this, a lot of my practice was based out in the community and I did teaching in schools and colleges. But really coming from that practice background, it was quite a commonplace thing that if you work with young people and work in that environment where maybe you come up against these challenging difficulties, that it's expected that you have to have some kind of way to unpack that and deal with the kind of trauma that can come from that, so you're not retaining it and potentially passing it on to other people. So there are professionals trained in the clinical supervision role, and the term clinical supervision is one thing, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it is quite commonplace. And then coming from teaching, it didn't ever seem to be a thing really when I was going into the room. And that's one of the things we wanted to look at, is a lot of practitioners that we've spoken to are used to this as practitioners, but then transitioning into higher education, that just seems to go away. But we still teach about it.
Yeah, yeah. Our whole study was kind of born out. We were really firstly interested in how people teach morality and ethics on programs where people are going to be community facing. So we were looking at people, for example, working on youth work and policing. That's what we were keen to learn about. And one of the things that really consistently came out was this want for supervision, for that place to, either with the students or as staff members themselves, have that non-judgmental place to discuss moral and ethical quandaries that they come up against, particularly those people who had had it before and knew how helpful it was. They came to higher education and either they felt maybe a bit disingenuous, perhaps because they're teaching students that clinical supervision is this wonderful thing that they'll get when they're professionals while not getting it themselves, or it was something that they missed because they really felt that they needed it because they're still dealing with really complicated issues. The things that students come to us about are so nuanced and complex, and you know, our role as lecturers is to kind of signpost them to the right place. But that doesn't mean that you haven't still kind of taken on some of that. You know, it's an emotionally laboursome role at times. And, you know, I think a lot of people who'd had supervision before felt that it would still be really valuable in this role now as well.
So I guess you then came to the usual conversation that stems from this sort of professional sort of inquiry itch. Well, how are we going to find out about this? What are we going to do? So what did you decide was the best way to go about investigating this?
So we started, just like we commonly would, just doing that literature review, doing that research, seeing what's out there. And it was quite bizarre looking at a lot of the different professional organizations that offer, that do run clinical supervision, and actually finding that they're, more often than not, there's no consistent definition for what supervision means in general. So it was trying to work out then how the different types of organizations came together to decide what supervision needs were, how those are addressed, for us to be able to start to even consider what that might look like for staff in higher education that are coming potentially from professional backgrounds, but not necessarily, that are then coming in working as higher education professionals. So we started off there realizing that actually there's not a lot of work there. There's a lot of work done on supervision itself, but the definitions are kind of accepted to be a little transitory and a little ephemeral. So from there, we decided this is where we need to start talking to the professionals and finding out what their experiences were. And that's where we wanted to come up with a model from there.
Yeah. So what, you know, a lot of different areas of practice, they will have kind of different ways in which supervision is normal for them. And that was kind of one of the big things, was they were so variable that, yeah. And also a big issue with clinical supervision is that sometimes people are mislabeling it or misunderstanding it as something more like coaching and mentoring, which obviously is quite fashionable at the moment, but it's not quite the same thing. So from that, we kind of started talking to current HE lecturers about what they would want. So we were asking people who teach on teacher training, youth and community policing, for example, to kind of find out what supervision could look like for them in a higher education context, not just kind of supervising students as part of their learning experience to kind of reflect on their practice and become better practitioners and learn those kind of ways of examining their own kind of preconceived ideas ready for when they go out in the world, but also for us as staff members, how it might fit into our current university structures and how it might help us to be better lecturers. I mean, that's the goal, is to help us all be better, really. Yeah.
And it's the well-being aspect as well. And the word well-being makes me cringe a little bit sometimes from what it can mean. But it's this safeguarding idea of a lot of the issues we deal with, like Louise said, are things that we then retain. We might speak to a student, have some awful information from them about things that have happened in their lives, do the correct things, follow the correct pathways that we're supposed to do, safeguarding and pass people on to the appropriate services so they can deal with it. But then what does that professional do with that information that they've taken on? Yep, we know we've done the right thing by following the procedures, but that doesn't make it go away. And this idea of vicarious trauma, of keeping and retaining that as professionals, there's no real place for us to go that's outside of the line management or outside of our teammates. And that was something that the participants felt was a common practice. If they'd never had supervision before, it was, well, you speak to your teammates. But the problem with that can come across, because what you're doing then is, again, passing that trauma on. And it's almost like having that little baseball of trauma that you're passing around the team. And everyone has their own little trauma ball as well that keeps getting passed around. And it's just, what do we do with that? How do we make something productive that can help people?
And I suppose one of the things we do share with those social workers and those housing workers and those youth workers who've come to become lecturers in that profession, as teachers who've not had clinical supervision when we've been down on the ground in the trenches, is the fact that we've had to all make this journey from being a practitioner of that profession to being a teacher of that profession in higher education. And certainly I know I've moaned long and hard about the fact that nobody gives you an instruction manual about how to do that. And if you're not careful, if you don't let go slightly of that identity as a practitioner, so in my case, if you don't let go of being a classroom teacher or being even a school-based teacher educator, a mentor in school, and try to forge a new identity, you just end up as a sort of slightly less effective version of what you were before. You know, I haven't got a class to demonstrate with. I don't work in a school anymore, so I probably don't quite have the credibility points, perhaps, of a school-based teacher educator. But nobody told me where my niche was, where I could still be part of that profession, but do something that the other people couldn't. So were you looking then not just for an ability to provide that kind of trauma support that you get in the profession, but also some sort of professional learning framework or manual for how to make that leap?
Yeah, I think it's quite important with that as well. And places like the Healthcare Professionals Council, for example, acknowledge that it's a big deal to have supervision for all the things we've mentioned already. But it's also a big learning and development opportunity for that member of staff. Because whatever experiences they're having, it's about reflecting and being reflexive to know what to do with those experiences once we have them. And especially once we transition from working in practice, working in communities, to what we do with that identity. And like you mentioned, Tom, it's quite difficult to know where that identity ends, where maybe a new identity begins, and what we actually do with those. Because that's one thing that is often missed in a lot of these conversations is, who actually am I as a professional? Where does my professional experience end and the new experience begins? But for a lot of our participants, actually, it didn't end. Those two identities, or more sometimes, depending on if they were teaching on multiple programs, often coexisted, and it caused a lot of difficulty for people understanding who they were, essentially, then what the professional role was, and then conflicting with their personal ways of viewing things as well. So it became really challenging.
Yeah, a lot of our participants kind of, I think, still really strongly identified with their previous job role. You know, they remained youth workers, for example, even though that's not their role now. And I think part of that also is because that role gave them a framework around which to build their operation within their job. Lots of kind of professional careers have these really clearly outlined frameworks of how to behave, particularly around morality and ethics, which obviously was the way that we were coming from it. But in higher education, there isn't that structured route in to become a lecturer where you're being given this really useful framework around which to build your professional identity and to build your kind of personal moral and ethical kind of behaviours that kind of hang on this skeleton of this is what we're expecting. That doesn't exist in the same way as it does for more professional roles, because, you know, you do a PGC and you're taught all of this stuff about how to be a teacher before you go out and become a teacher. You know, you want to be a youth worker, you do qualifications in youth work, and then you go out and do that. But to be a lecturer, there isn't a lecturer course that teaches you these frameworks before you become. So yeah, I think a lot of what's come out of this for us is around those professional identities, how that links to moral and ethical behaviours, because I think for people who had previously been professionals elsewhere, they were just bringing that and applying that here. And yeah, that was really interesting for us, was understanding where they'd kind of brought these ethical frameworks and were applying them here, where as opposed to kind of having one in this role as a lecturer and then going from there.
It's making me reflect a little bit on something that maybe some of our listeners won't know about, which is, I'm probably going to wreck the acronym now, is it the Higher Education Academy or Association? Something they sort of really expedite and push you to go through really quickly when you become when you start to work in higher education, is to get fellowship. And I'm reflecting on the sort of thing I had to do, which is basically like an extended essay about like how I've developed my pedagogy and my practice. And it's quite sort of theory into practice and how I work with my students. Really wasn't about my identity now that I was in higher education. And like the sort of criteria that they like you to sort of hit and sort of weave into that application didn't really speak to any of that. So that it's clearly not influenced that thinking or, you know, that standard. So you're absolutely right, there's a real gap. I'm wondering, when you were doing your initial reading and research and maybe since, are there any HEIs that are using it? Like, is there an outlier like in the UK where this is being used, or is this a complete gap? Do you know?
There seems to be a large gap with it. I think some of the institutions that we looked at are possibly using some of the modules that they may use for example, social work courses where staff are still reflecting. But quite often what we found so far is a lot of these models are within teams still. So there's still a social work team may deliver it to other social workers. Or what one of the scary findings that actually came out of this was that a lot of staff members that are actually still having supervision are paying for it privately outside of universities, because they are looking for that experience outside of the team to be able to do that, and outside of the supervision framework of line management and university oversight, because a lot of the programs that we found that are in existence tend to have that crossover where line management is involved and supervision is performative based as well. So it looks at your performance as an educator. So a lot of staff were unwilling to discuss certain concepts with their supervisors in higher education institutions because it was potentially going to be used on a performance review. And nobody wants to say, I really struggle doing this. This is affecting me on a personal level, because they don't want it to reflect in their job performance. And so there's a lot that's being internalized, which then defies the purpose of having supervision to begin with.
And of course, that would be a lot of pressure for line managers as well, because they're not trained supervisors. You know, people who are clinical supervisors have specific training to do that. So no one there is playing a role in the kind of supervisor relationship effectively, unless they've had that kind of supervision. And then, of course, how do you, as a line manager, how would you disentangle your role as line manager kind of protect that person, but also make sure that everything is still being delivered, versus supporting that person to maybe make a small mistake and then learn from it and develop as a professional. So yeah, it just doesn't seem to work that way. You need someone outside of the team and outside of where there isn't that power dynamic at play.
So you sort of identify this gap here where universities are probably mostly interested in taking, and I think you described yourself, you know, you're like the proper academic in the room because you've just been an academic. You haven't done the professional kind of detour. And they teach people who have, you know, done degrees and masters and PhDs to do sort of teachery things in a university. Great, that's obviously what the university wants to do, but can't deal with a complex professional identity where maybe you've been a teacher and you know about teaching, but you don't know about other stuff. You've described that this gap that you can fall down because of this lack of provision can mean that some of these professionals who've come out of their profession can end up making some pretty bad mistakes because the people that they are teaching are students, either undergrad or postgrad, and are in some way different from the service users that they used to work with. And what kinds of things were you finding out?
So with that, what was really interesting with that is when people were coming from that professional role, the professional role is based around things like national frameworks, national competencies, and ways of doing things. So having those frameworks and regulations and what we can and cannot do, and that often shapes the decisions that we make. And that was very clear that when people were coming from a professional role, that that's what they were expected to do during their profession. The issues we found is that actually some of the people that were struggling with the transition into higher education then found that those roles didn't exist anymore. Those frameworks didn't exist anymore, sorry. So they may exist in abstract because they still exist in the community for the professional, and the students will need to follow them when they undertake the role, or if they are undertaking placements, for example, then yes, they will. But the academic discussion around what that actually means to live with those decisions, for example, was a real, real struggle, and something that the professionals experienced in supervision got to discuss and disentangle a little bit to say what it means to make a decision that actually when you go home at night, you struggle with, because what you professionally need to do is not something that you may necessarily have agreed with personally or a decision you would have made personally. Well, great, we can have supervision, we can discuss what that means and then disentangle that so it doesn't impact your profession later on. The issue that they found with teaching that to students is because students weren't receiving this supervision, or they were receiving it from the teachers teaching about supervision, there was this real split identity that we're creating for student practitioners anyway. So they were told to consider what they would think in the role and how they would act in the role according to the competencies. But then the academic discussion around what it means to actually live with those decisions and to be able to make those decisions and see what they mean to you personally, and how those, my favorite quote is the swampy lowlands of making these decisions and what it actually means to live with the gray and potentially things that you might not want to do yourself, was really difficult for the student practitioners, because they have that dual role of when you're on placement, you are a professional, but you are still a student. And then when you come into the university, you are a student who is also a student practitioner. And it was very tricky because the teachers themselves then were again feeling that dual role. Like Louise said, some of our practitioners still identified as a practitioner first as last and not as an academic. The academic was the second role. But obviously, from an institutional perspective, the one role has to take priority.
And that makes it really hard. I think, you know, we have lots of wonderful academics in our school who, and beyond, in lots of institutions who have been these professionals and who can operate within those really kind of difficult, sticky situations, who they come to higher education and they're being told, no, your role stops at referring to student services. So I think that, you know, it doesn't quite sit right when you have the skills, perhaps the skills and knowledge to maybe support learners more, to shut that door and say, okay, you need to go to here now, and that's the, I can offer you an extension, I can talk to you about this, that and the other, but I can't go further. And I think that makes the transition from one role to another very difficult, because they've come from very different expectations in terms of the support that they're providing. And so this was one of the kind of main discussions that is coming out of our second phase about what it means to be a lecturer and what it means to have the roles that we have, and how does that fit with our kind of moral and ethical frameworks, that our personal ones, you know, how do we sit with these decisions that we have to make day by day while trying to support our students in the best way possible, but while also fitting within the framework that the university provides us to work within, or the kind of implied frameworks that we have to work within.
So it's I'm convinced that there's a need for this. Totally convinced. And I hope it is sort of causing some of our teacher educators out there and teachers and student teachers who are listening to sort of think and reflect, you know, could I do with this person in my life? But then I'm wondering now sort of how it would work, given that sort of sometimes these issues sort of crop up, you know, today when I'm teaching. And then what do I do? Do I then go straight to my clinical supervisor, or, you know, how might this work? Are there any sort of pitfalls that you've come to sort of alight upon?
It's quite variable in terms of how it might work. Some people, so for example, like counsellors might meet regularly, maybe weekly or something, with their supervisor, and they have that kind of opportunity to bring everything that's happened in the preceding week or the preceding month and explain all of that. There are like more flexible frameworks where, you know, perhaps in the context of like peer-to-peer. But yeah, the way that it kind of works might also depend on the supervisor, on the kind of background that they're bringing to it as well.
I think one of the tricky things that did come up is where some of the practitioners had been teaching about it, had been delivering supervision in like a sterile environment where they're teaching students what supervision meant, is one of the risks that kept cropping up is the risk of those hypothetical supervision sessions bordering into real supervision sessions where maybe the practitioner shouldn't be delivering those kinds of sessions. And it's a risk when we teach things about topics like therapeutic topics and how we can do an activity therapeutically, but we're not teaching a counselling session and we're not getting practitioners that are going to deliver an actual supervision session to students in front of other students by accident, and that student taking that experience away. Because obviously there's that boundary that we have to have as educators that is quite difficult when that crosses that line with teaching practice. So that was one of the things that kept coming up with a lot of our different participants.
Yeah, and one of the like ways to kind of support that, and what's quite normal within supervision, is this idea of like having a contract. So you know, when you start supervision with that person, what the expectations are, where information can and can't go, obviously depending on, you know, things like people's safety, for example, as with any kind of confidential conversation. But having that kind of contract in advance so everyone knows that they are kind of within those rules, safe to be open and honest, and it won't go any further, and they can really talk honestly about what they need to talk about.
I'm also curious about this supervisory role and how it is different to a coach, because we've been doing quite a bit about coaching on the PGC and our ITE programs, and just making this distinction that the coach is not the person who gives the answers to the person being coached. They're there to just ask questions. And I wonder, is a supervisor in this kind of clinical supervision arrangement, are they there to give any answers, or are they just sort of a listener?
I think that's one of the important distinctions where coaching really ends, because some of the discussions we've had is that crossover between coaching and supervision. The big difference is with coaching, you are then promoting the other person to find the solutions and promoting and encouraging that autonomy, that agency to make decisions, which is, of course, fantastic. With supervision, you have that professional in the room that is there, that is also a professional in the industry you're looking at. So it's typically done within industry, which again leads to issues within higher education. But the idea is then they can help to say, well, maybe what you did there isn't correct, that maybe you made a poor decision. This is what we can do. And again, that can relate to things like frameworks and national standards. But the idea then is that they can help that person to reflect on their practice and come to a consensus, but actually be that voice in the room that says, maybe I disagree with what you did right there, and challenge it, which the coach may not be best positioned to do, but the supervisor absolutely can. It can be a case of, I've had a really bad day, this is what happened, and the supervisor say, well, actually, maybe this is what you could have done instead, and provide solutions or at least at pathways for that person to look to overcome the issues that they faced. Whereas coaching relies more on the autonomy of the individual then, and encouraging that autonomy, the supervisor can almost cross that line and say, No, I think you were wrong there.
That's really clear. Thank you. That's very helpful.
I'm just sort of reflecting now. And I don't know if there's an answer to this question or, you know, if this feels like a question that's just horrible, I think it's more just like a discussion thing for us really in a way. The thing that really grabs me about this is the fact that this has never been a thing in teaching. And I'm thinking school teaching now particularly. We've never had it. And so in some ways I'm coming at this from the position of not missing what I never had, you know. But as Emma says, it sounds great, really useful. So I'm sitting here thinking, why have we never had this in teaching? I'm thinking, because it's probably really expensive, isn't it? Because you've got to put the time and you've got to do the training and you've got to link people up with people. And in teaching, we just always improvise and do things on a shoestring. You know, I think I've got a clinical supervisor. I think it's Emma. But we found each other and, you know,
totally nobody, not trained.
Nobody pays her to do it. She's not trained, but she does a very good job. And then, I'm thinking, yes, but all of those other professions like social work and youth work and things, they're not exactly awash with money. So that excuse sort of evaporates. So why have we never had it in teaching?
Now we're in there.
I mean, we're in speculative territory here, but it's just the thing that really interests me. So why do we never get this stuff? Why do we always improvise this stuff out of string and glue, you know, in teaching world? I don't know.
Yeah. I think one of our, a couple of our, not supervisors, a couple of our participants kind of mentioned that they were starting to see it in schools, but head teachers were getting it first before the teachers.
Yeah. And then we're disseminated amongst the rank and file, because of course that's how it should work.
I did wonder if
I've had a training session, yes. So now I am the expert and can deliver. And of course there's issues there with that. I think that was one of the things that kept cropping up with it. I think for me, it's looking at it from that cost benefit of what it is. So yes, it's expensive. Yes, you are potentially employing someone to do that either additional role for people across the university or bringing someone into it. But also, it's that cost of what well-being, mental illness, and all the type of burnout that teachers go through. When we look at the cost nationally that can have, and even just at an institutional basis, and compare that with the potential costs of supervision where we can deal with these kinds of issues before they become so severe that people need to take time off work and people need to be replaced in the classroom. Let's get it right first and let's put facilities in place to help people. Yeah. Let's look at the cost of that.
And I wonder, I mean, I always feel like I'm being really rude about schools when I say this, but they are, I know this because I've been in them, you know, I've worked in them. They are very, very hierarchical places. And I just wonder whether culturally it just doesn't fit in the same way, perhaps. And there needs to be that culture change of actually, you know, oh, line managers is fine. Line managers can supervise, you know.
Yeah. We're actually, like, all the research around supervision shows pretty unanimously that line managers shouldn't be the supervisors for those reasons around just feeling free to have a conversation where you can kind of unburden about things that have gone on in your practice that over that time period.
Yeah, and about being able to make mistakes or just voice an opinion and voice something where you maybe feel like, oh, so frustrated in this situation and this is how I felt, without it being related to your job security by doing those kinds of venting experiences, and then being able to have that discussion of why maybe you came to that. Because again, it's not saying that the person making these claims or having these conversations in the first place and having supervision is always in the right, because it may just need that professional conversation outside of line management to say, you're in the wrong there. Or maybe the opposite, that yeah, you are in the right. However, these are the restraints that we deal with, and it's being able to live with those maybe inconsistencies with what we feel inside and what we're required to do as professionals.
And also the inconsistencies between our own kind of moral and ethical kind of ontologies and the rules in which we are having to behave, because that is how the system works. That is what we have to do within our job role. Like, sometimes, you know, sometimes it doesn't align entirely because as lecturers, you know, I'm not a qualified counsellor, but I hate, you know, having upset students in my office. I want to do everything I can, but also I'm not qualified to do anything and have to pass that person over to the more qualified person. But that is a difficult, knowing how to kind of have that transition, pass them over to someone who's more qualified, who they don't know, is a difficult, it's a difficult thing to do in that moment. And yeah.
Do you foresee, and I'm going to aim this at you, Louise, because as Tom said earlier on, you've come from a sort of academic background. Do you feel from your perspective that, you know, you're not in a community facing, well, you are now, but on the programmes you are now, but you weren't before, like sort of community facing roles. Do you feel like this would help you, and do you think this will be useful to other academics?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess for people who don't know me, so I went undergrad, master's, PhD, lecturer, and so I haven't left the womb that is university life.
You are community facing in that, you know, you're working with students.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
They are our community, so it kind of feels a bit weird, but we're making a distinction, aren't we, about, you know,
yeah, like I've never worked in a profession outside of higher education, and prior to being here I was teaching straight psychology, so I was kind of very kind of theory and research driven. And then when I came here, I was teaching psychology as applied to education, but not having that kind of practitioner experience of having been a teacher. But I still feel like I would really benefit, 100% feel like I would really benefit from supervision, because there are still times when, as I'm sure we all experience, where actually there has been a situation that I'm not sure how to manage because we don't have a guidance or framework that matches every single situation that we're going to encounter in our practice. I often question my own practice and often question whether I've dealt with that situation in the best way possible, because I, you know, that's a, every few months I'm in a situation that I've never been in before, with a disclosure or something in my practice that's literally never happened in the years that I've been teaching, and have to kind of manage that on the cuff, as we all do. And so having a supervisor, to, you know, someone more experienced than myself who would be a soundboard, particularly, you know, when I was a more junior lecturer, having not been a lecturer for all that long, it would have been extra useful.
Maybe a happy byproduct of this, which on the one hand is that people feel better at work and feel happier, and, you know, that's all great, but maybe a bit of a dirty word, like improving standards and actually making what we do better. Like, is it possible that, you know, someone that's not there to sort of be your coach and your mentor and your assessor or your line manager, but someone who is there to hold you to account in a way, you know, like you said, Dan, you know, they're not there to tell you that you've done right when you've done wrong. But is this a different kind of way that feels a bit less sort of neoliberal, let's make everything fit in nice, neat boxes and be able to measure it all? And I just wonder, is there evidence to show that this actually increases standards? Did that come up in any of the things that you read?
Yeah, some of our participants kind of said that it was a nice place to, or a useful place to kind of examine preconceived ideas, you know, for professionals, but also more so for students, while they're kind of coming in with these biases they've brought with them from wherever they've come from. And it gives them a kind of an opportunity to think how their biases and their experiences might inform the way they are behaving with service users, how they might react in different situations. So in one way, it does help them to maybe reflect on how to be better practitioners for their service users. Also, some participants kind of felt like supervision was a good place to think about those kind of moral and ethical kind of standards that we all have within ourselves, but maybe we don't examine. I think when asked, we know what we would feel is right or wrong in different situations, but without sitting down and talking about it and kind of voicing maybe why you feel a certain way, you might not reflect on that. So that's another way in which supervision can really help, because it'll help you kind of understand your own ethics and morality and how that would apply in different situations within a given framework of kind of ethical practice. So I think in general it helps you to maybe more honestly reflect on and dissect your performance in a way that you wouldn't in a, you know, a kind of, a context with your line manager where you're maybe setting very numeracy-based targets for things that you're going to achieve and saying whether or not you've ticked those off in the previous year. These are kind of harder perhaps to measure, but still extremely important aspects of our practice.
Yeah, it was at this point, I think, in your presentation, it's all coming back to me now, that it got me reflecting on something that Tom was talking about earlier on. When you transition to becoming a teacher educator in a university and you're no longer in school, and yet you're still having to go out to do visits and observe often with a mentor who is still in school and a teacher educator in that context. And this dilemma that has occurred to me, that if I'd had a clinical supervisor, I probably would have worked my way through, is like, who am I now? And what is this power dynamic? And who am I to come in and decide what that teacher that we're both observing's teaching is good or not, when this person next to me has seen them teach far more than I have? They know this school better than I do. So what is my role now, and how do I morally, ethically, supportively work with that person and not make them feel like I am somehow judging everybody in this room? What right do I have? Yeah. So that's my sort of concrete example of how I think clinical supervision would have really helped me. And I know Tom and I have had lots of just ad hoc conversations about it. So I can see how that would really potentially improve things.
Yeah, our participants really, there seemed to be a real appetite for it. In what we found, it was a really surprising but quite consistent finding from our kind of first phase, was how much they seem to want supervision in some shape or form.
And it's not to say that, because there might be people listening that think, well, we do something similar in the classroom anyway as educators. It's what we do. We create these safe spaces in a classroom. Students can express themselves and so on and so on, especially with teacher training as well. We want that room where you can reflect on your practices and not necessarily be judged or punished or disciplined or anything like that for what we're doing. And absolutely, we do very similar practices. I think the main distinction there is, like you said, Emma, is that separation of identity, of we can do similar activities and group work in a classroom where we're promoting reflection on our practice. Did we make the right decisions? What other avenues could we have gone to? And it's a safer space to be able to do that. The difference being is when you're doing it as that educator teaching other practitioners or teaching other teachers to do things, is how does that professional running that room distance themselves from their role as the educator and then running that supervisory session? Because even if you think, right, I'm not assessing the students now, you may have professional competencies that you still have to underpin. And if students come to you and say something that you think, wow, that is not professionally acceptable, can you ever really take that out of your mind? Does that ever really go away, or has your opinion been colored? What do you do with that information then? How do you process that as the professional going forward? That's the distinction between the classroom practice and then the supervision practice itself, is having that professional that's trained to deliver those sessions and not part of maybe the assessment process, and especially performative line management and beyond. It means that those conversations can happen, and providing there's no major safeguarding statements made and disclosures and things like that, it's a safer space. And as long as that contract that is initially given is followed, then those conversations stay and those conversations can happen. You can say the wrong thing. You can say something that's been grating on you because from your experience, your childhood, your family, your friends, your whatever has been playing on your mind, that I just want to ask this question to someone. Supervision means you can do that and get feedback on it without having to worry, ooh, did I say too much?
And this is another way your work is refreshing, actually, because you've name-checked your title there, creating a safe space. And I know you said earlier, well-being makes you cringe. number 978 on the list of things that annoy me is people promising a safe space as if it's the easiest thing in the world to do. And actually, this is not just in the sort of professional side of university. You know, those of us who run programs which are connected to community facing professions, it's a really live issue in universities, full stop, isn't it? The offering of a safe space. We know that we get people coming for interview on the PGCE who say, oh, I want to be a teacher because I want to make a safe space for XYZ. Safe spaces are everywhere, apparently, and dead easy to create. And yet, we sort of know that's not the case. So, I mean, how close are you to being able to pin down for us as educators where we can, where we can't, how we do, what the features are? What's your work looking like now and what are the next steps?
I think there's a lot of different properties that our participants have pulled out for us. So obviously the power dynamic is a big one we've touched on already. Someone like a line manager, or I suppose someone who's directly above you in some way and has power over you, might not be a good fit as a supervisor. Some of the kind of informal discussions we've had is around, in terms of how it would work in higher education, is how would we maybe do it across school or across team at least, so that you would be, you know, someone from teacher training might be supervised by someone from youth and community, for example. You know, how might that work? Because you can't have that discomfort that it's going to have a negative impact, or that worry that it will have a negative impact on your career.
But at the same time, am I right in thinking that that person would also need to know enough about what you do to be able to say no, what you did? So if someone from youth and community doing that with me perhaps wouldn't be able to do that.
And these are some of the issues we've been coming up against, because we are lecturers. So so in that way, any lecturer might do.
But we're really not.
But ideally, you would want someone who has taught something very similar to you, but then you run the risk of it being very siloed, and then there are other risks there in terms of honesty if you're working with someone day to day.
I was going to say, in some ways, it's actually can sometimes be quite useful to have to explain stuff and walk away from the shared understandings and the shared assumptions. But sometimes you have to do so much explaining, it's always kind of you're not sure you want to even start.
No. I think that's why one of the questions we're really excited by is, what does that model actually look like? So consistently our participants are telling us, well, maybe the model we're using in practice, as in the practitioners we've already mentioned before, maybe those models aren't what we need. And I think that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer at the moment, is what would a model for HE actually look like? And I said earlier about the term clinical supervision. I hate it because, again, there's a lot of things I don't like coming out right now.
You're like me, Dan.
It's just me now, just that I don't like this.
But calling it clinical, it does have a connotation that is perhaps a bit different.
That you're sitting down with a therapist in a room and everything's sterile and clean. And it doesn't have to be that. And it's what supervision looks like for us in HE. Does it have to be run with someone who has that industry-based experience, or are we treating the educator role in itself as the profession to look at it from? Because does it matter? And to some participants it does, and some participants it didn't. And that's where we still have that dual discussion that we're still having amongst ourselves of, do the professionals need to have that industry level experience, or are we looking at the higher education delivery of supervision as the industry experience and the challenges faced within that? So that's the tricky part at the moment, is delineating where the line between industry professional and industry profession as higher education industry professional sits, because a lot of us teach across different subject areas, and in schools and colleges, again, when I taught in schools and colleges, you teach multiple different areas potentially a lot of the time, and it's keeping multiple hats and these different masks that we wear anyway. And should therefore the model for higher education stand outside the models that have come before?
For some professions, it's absolutely an expectation that you have supervision. It's frowned upon if you don't. One of the things that does come out of a lot of research and our findings as well is that there needs to be a certain degree of optionality for it to be as effective as possible. If you are forced into it, there might be some reluctance to have that open and honest conversation. Mm. And so, that there's kind of some work to be done over how an optional framework in HE might work as well, because also I feel almost everyone would probably benefit from supervision. But if you are more inclined towards that sort of practice anyway, you might appeal to it more. The people who are more reflective anyway might be more likely to go to supervision, and so you might not be reaching the people for whom supervision might be the most effective. So it's kind of tricky, and then mixed in with all of that, of course, is the question of resource and having the time and the space and all of those magical things.
This will be everywhere because we've all got money to burn in higher education.
Everywhere, right? The other side is just avoiding it being institutionalized, that it becomes this mandatory thing that you have to do. And it becomes a tick box exercise of, well, if we do 6 supervisory sessions, we're fixed.
Oh, that's an education thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not something that is just, we do 6 sessions and all of a sudden all the problems go away. Yeah. That this can be an ongoing thing, but also does it have to be, I need it now because, but I can't, I've got it next Thursday because that's when it's scheduled in because I'm teaching. It's the modality, like we said, of how it actually comes across practically and how we deliver these things is different from the industry, because in industry, you can set time aside to do these things. You may have working hours where you deal with service users. With universities and higher education in general, so again, there's a lot more pressure on time and being able to do things and our resources in general of, well, where do you fit it in? Are we doing it just periodically where we just dip in as and when, or is it scheduled? And if it's scheduled, how do we do that?
Yeah. And the availability of supervisors and HE is very different because there is an expectation within these other types of careers that supervision is required, and so there are existing frameworks, there are ways to access them that are well established for there to be a kind of big change in higher education that is going to require substantial upskilling and training of individuals within higher education, or the bringing in from people from outside potentially, which brings with it its own problems, because really you want someone who is familiar with HE, and because universities all operate fairly differently and have their own kind of esoteric rules and regs, it means that you might have a supervisor who works in one university and you're kind of talking a different language. So yeah, lots of things, practical things to think about as well.
More questions than answers at this stage, but I mean, that's research, isn't it? Really interesting talking to you, and I've no doubt that we'll ask you back at some point once you've got the model sussed and it's ready to roll. You've done your homework for us.
Yes.
You've got something to try, Louise, that links to what we've been talking about. So we'll go with that one first, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that kind of, as we said before, that came out a lot was what does it mean to be a higher education lecturer? Lots of people kind of felt like because there wasn't that kind of formal induction into the entire career, as it were, they kind of missed that stage of kind of reforming, or missed out on, or felt that they hadn't had that kind of ability to form their identity as lecturers, and perhaps brought with them the identities that they had before. So what we kind of considered as your something to try was perhaps to note down what you feel your professional identity is, whatever that may be currently, and perhaps how that links to your personal identity, and if there are any differences or any similarities between who we are as humans overall and what our identities are as teachers or lecturers or whatever it is that you do, how might those two spheres interact and inform one another, and particularly if there are differences, how might that impact the way that you behave in a personal or professional sphere?
And I think there's real mileage there actually for our colleagues out in school, because we know that there's lots of interesting stuff out there about how people end up being mentors to student teachers. They often get picked because they're a good teacher of pupils. They sometimes get picked because they just don't run fast enough in the other direction. But there's a change in professional identity right there. They've gone from just teaching pupils, I say just, you know, it's a big deal, but also then trying to put a different hat on and mentor a student teacher who is teaching their pupils. And so there's been a shift in identity there. So for them to do that sort of exercise will be really good. And maybe even for student teachers as well, who are, as you said earlier, that, you know, student professionals are juggling that professional versus learner identity. And so for everyone to take a moment to stick things down and start to make sense of them is possibly good. Dan, you've got something interesting.
Well, I don't know about interesting. I like it anyway.
We'll be the judge of that.
You can be the judge of that. And it's based around this idea, really. So one of the challenges we have when we speak to the students is getting them to unpick these different types of identities that they might have. What is your role as a teacher? What is your role as this police officer or this person working in a prison, as a student, as just someone trying to navigate the world? And it's great having all of these different identities that they have to have. But one of the things we try and do then is integrate that into the content that we teach. So, for example, we teach a lot about things like cognitive behavioral role play and what it means to provide therapeutic situations for people and how they can navigate these different roles and these different experiences that they have. Great. Let's make it a game. So I come from education, and play is always the big thing, and everyone knows how great it is. I don't think play should ever go away. It works great for children. Why can't it work for everyone else as well? At some point, we've stopped just playing. Let's bring that into the room as well. So one of the ways we do that is unpacking things like Carl Jung with the personas and the different masks that we put on. Let's take these actual metaphors and use them in a role play setting. So we take the idea of cognitive role play. So you take on a persona, you take on a mask, you take on a role or a character, and then we explore these different types of moral situations through storytelling and play. And those of you who are listening in thinking, is he talking about Dungeons and Dragons?
I was gonna say, this is a very fancy way of talking about D&D, Dan.
Kind of. I'm trying. One of the students said this recently as well. Are we talking about? No, we're not. We are talking about these types of modalities. Yeah. So it's using that type of role play, that type of taking on a situation, and instead of just making it really sterile and artificial, and taking on something that again can be really just dry when you're talking about it, let's take the same sort of moral dilemma. Let's take that challenge you've got in your professional world. Let's make it sci-fi. Let's make it fantasy. Let's do something where it does make it potentially ridiculous and silly. Great. I'm all for ridiculous and silly when we're playing a game. And instead of it being you making those decisions and going through those experiences, it's your character. So it's not you. What you're free to do then is, if we set a story and we set a world with rules and people in it that you have to interact with, the beautiful thing we can do is give you a challenge, and you're not doing it as you. You're not trying to overcome that challenge as you. You can, but the beauty is you get outside of your own head, you get out of your own life. It's controlled escapism in an environment where you can make a mistake, and that's fine. We make a mistake, we talk about the consequences, we can roll the situation back. You try again, you try something new. So we can have these students that are going in and they've got magic, they've got swords, they've got whatever they want in their little environment, and we can set them up against a challenge. They make decisions and they get it completely wrong. Great. Why? What did you do? So there's games that you can play with students to get them to explore all these things, and then just underpin it with all the exact psychology that we would be teaching them anyway. But it's basing it in a way that makes it fun, makes it silly. And if at the end of the day, the best case scenario is they leave with a smile on their face, because isn't Dan a nerd? Yes. That's the mask I'm willing to wear.
You're definitely speaking my language, Dan. You're effectively plundering the drama pedagogy cupboard and using it in your context, and I'm all for that. But you're right, it kind of creates that distance, doesn't it? That distance from you that in some ways makes a bit of a healthier and safer space, isn't it? Because, you know, let's not get into the trenches and talk about the issues and you know, take ourselves to that really emotional, sad place. Let's create a bit of distance through play. I like it.
Very nice. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you to Dan Williams, who's now well on his way to being a veteran.
Thank you.
And Dr. Louise Allen Walker, who's now even more veteran. What comes after veteran? I'm not quite.
Senior veteran.
Senior.
I think that's probably more offensive.
Right. Senior veteran. Senior veteran, Dr. Louise Allen Walker. And if you're veteran, I don't know what we are.
Old Crocs.
Old Crocs. In the studio of plague with the studio poltergeist. We will hopefully be back healthy and happy in 2 weeks' time. Bye for now. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. The special guests this episode were Dr. Louise Allen Walker and Dan Williams from our Criminology and Professional Policing programmes here at Cardiff Met, and thanks to them for joining us in the studio. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamburn and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on X if there's anyone still out there at Talk Teaching Pod. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching. Thank you.